This is BCFM.
BCFM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Abbey Wood sold off to NATO defence contractors. Their Orwellian permanent war's almost in the bag. Well, it's the biggest local story. We haven't had covered much around here. It's the Conservative Defence Secretary Philip Hammond who wants to sell off Abbey Wood defence equipment and support. 7,000 local people work on MOD procurement, so the defence industry will be awarding contracts to themselves. And guess what? We'll be paying. It'll probably go to a US defence contractor, that particular privatisation, if it happens. We're joined by independent and Evening Standard journalist Mark Leftley, who's been following what's one of the most controversial government proposals to date. Plus, Daphne Havercroft from the South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group is returning to report on how NHS privatisation is going along. But first, I'm joined on the line by Mark Leftley from The Independent. Hi, Mark. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Well, first of all, what are the plans for Abbey Wood? I mean, we know we've got around about 7,000 people actually working up there, another several thousand in other parts of the country. What's the plan?
Well, the idea is that you would give the running and operation of defence equipment support to a private sector consortium. The government believes that this would mean that you would have greater commercial nous. So when you're buying a jet, even guns, battle gear, whatever, you'd be buying at a better price, that they would be better on negotiations and stricter on their controls. So for a budget of around $14 billion a year, you'd be able to buy more guns for your buck.
And what's the evidence that it is actually going to be cheaper?
Well, this is the interesting thing. Nothing like this has ever really been tried before in the world, certainly not on this scale. The evidence at the moment is really just that there's waste as the way things are run. This is an idea from Bernard Gray, a former journalist at the Financial Times, who's chief of defence materiel, which basically runs the agency. And his punt is that this would save money.
Okay, so but has he actually got any evidence for that? Because you know, obviously, if it's run by a private industry, they may actually be looking to make a profit for shareholders to pay very much larger wages than would be paid by the civil service as well.
Well, that's one of the ideas. If you're if you've got the freedom to pay better money, more money, then you can retain the skills. A lot of people in the MOD and defence equipment support do go elsewhere. His idea. And it's shown by other outsourcing contracts, but not necessarily within defence, but in other areas of government, is that this can be more efficient.
Now, I mentioned the figure of 7,000 up at Abbey Wood, but how many jobs are affected at this and other sites?
Well, I mean, according to the website, 16,500. I mean, I've seen various estimates, but if you call it around 15,000, then the number of jobs could be anything, because once you've got a private sector organisation involved, one of the efficiencies, as they like to call it, that will be there, will be in cutting jobs. And some estimates I've got go as far as 10,000.
Crikey. Well, so how much does defence equipment and support actually cost to run, and how big a budget does it control? You mentioned the figure of $14 billion a minute ago.
Yeah, it has a $14 billion budget, which covers everything from, let's say, submarines, battle gear, whatever. So it's a huge amount of money.
Okay, so which companies are in the running then to take it over at the moment, and have any dropped out of the process?
Yeah, you've basically got the only firms that can do something of this scale, and even then it's unproven, large US firms. So the two that are leading two consortiums are Bechtel and CH2M Hill. Bechtel are currently involved in the Crossrail project in London. CH2M Hill were involved with getting the Olympics under its revised budget. In fact, they partially oversaw that. But there's a number of British partners with both of them. So the likes of Atkins, the accountant PricewaterhouseCoopers, and a name that most people should know now, Serco, which is kind of currently under investigation for a number of dodgy contracts that it's got with the government.
That's right. I think they were falsifying information about prisoners and this kind of thing, with saying that they were some of the prisoners were still incarcerated when actually they'd been released, and also that some prisoners were actually alive when they died. That's Serco, so they're one of the groups in the running. I mean, have we got any sort of major bidders who are just British, or is this it most likely to go to a contract or a bid which is led by a US firm? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's led by a US firm. Actually, you did ask as well who else had been in it. There was another couple of US firms who are working together, KBR and URS, who pulled out because of potential conflicts. And that's one of the major issues here, that every company involved in this has huge conflicts of interest. So, for example, nearly all of them work for BAE Systems on other types of deals. And under this contract, they would have to hand out deals and negotiate with BAE Systems, even though in other areas of their business they work for them. So it raises the issue of how can you really be, how can you separate your concerns over other areas of your work.
Now, this whole thing of conflicts of interest is quite clearly one of the main concerns here, because if you've got people who stand to benefit when they award themselves a contract, I mean, how did this idea even get in the door? I mean, it seems to me that should prohibit anybody from actually bidding any of these defence contractors if they're actually overseeing contracts that could be awarded to themselves.
Well, let me tell you one of the MOD's responses, and this is where the MOD have been... I just think it's very unsatisfactory the way they've answered questions of this. They'll say that according to their own definition of conflicts of interest or their own measures of it, that certain firms have been excluded from the process and these ones have been allowed through. Now, what we haven't really been shown is how they've measured the conflict of interest, how they've decided that this firm will be able to exclude themselves from potential conflicts of interest when this one can't. And until they can do that, I mean, you just really haven't got any satisfactory answers here.
Well, I bet you know what they'll say is they'll probably say, I'm afraid we can't tell you because it could be a threat to national security.
Or commercial confidentiality.
Ah, right, there's that one as well. Now, I know you've dug out some fascinating revolving doors that have been going on here, people from working one minute for the MOD or the government or even in Downing Street. Can you tell us about some of those?
Yeah, okay. I don't want to be unfair to Bechtel, because CHTM Hill has as well, but the ones we dug out on Bechtel include Richard Freer, who used to work for who used to be number 10 policy advisor on defence. He's gone to work for them. As things stand, he's working on a project in the west coast of America, but it's been made pretty clear that he will eventually work on this project and other defence ones like it. You wouldn't hire him unless you were going to use his defence now, so I mean, it makes perfect sense in a way, but whether it's right is another thing. Then more recently we discovered Clive Billiard, who used to look after what's called strategic weapons and oversaw the construction of submarines, so right at the heart of what defence and equipment support does, and he's in there looking after the bid at the moment.
Amazing. And also, I mean, you know, there is the I mean, whenever there's a privatisation, we've had all this IPO today with Royal Mail. People are wondering, well, when I be able to buy shares in this if they're privatising it? I mean, is that the same? Is it going to be the same as the similar sort of thing as the Royal Mail privatisation, where people can make a few bob?
Well, this is the thing that the government will certainly accuse journalists of calling it a privatisation. The unions are calling it a privatisation, when strictly speaking, it isn't. But because you're not selling shares, you're not fully privatising, but what you are doing is you're giving the private sector control of it. So we would refer to it as a semi-privatisation, I guess.
Now, no other country has done this. You pointed that out right at the start. So what are the arguments being given, I mean, particularly by this FT journalist that you mentioned at the start as well, as to why Britain should stick their neck out and do this while other countries have never even contemplated it?
Well, one of the reasons is because others haven't. He's saying that you need to be very radical in what you do. I mean, if you look at it from a theoretical standpoint and what he's thinking, I mean, he's not looking at this in a bad way. He's not trying to do anything crazy. It's just the practicalities that appear not to work. I'd say the Americans are very concerned, are deeply concerned over what's happened here, because their worry is that with a private sector leading this kind of project, that things could easily leak, and that might even undermine our relationship with the US. But I can say on Capitol Hill and the Pentagon, they think this is a crazy idea.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, most of the sort of privatisation types of things that go on in the UK, we seem to be almost copying what's going on in the US. Are you saying that actually the Pentagon is themselves are saying, what are you doing? I mean, they're actually questioning the wisdom of this right in a very fundamental way.
Yes, they are. Again, the MOD will probably tell you that they're working very closely with them, etc., etc., and they have set up, I can't remember the exact word, but a task force, effectively, from the US who are working through some of these issues. But certainly the people I've spoken to who are pretty high up over there, they do think it's quite crazy to put such a major issue of national security into the hands of the private sector. And their issue is not a philosophical one, really. It's just that it's not workable.
Now, how likely is this to actually go ahead? Because I read in the Sunday Times, I think they managed to scoop you, Mark, I'm not sure, but on the 22nd of September, that the Defence Secretary's ordered an urgent review of this part privatisation of Britain's weapons buying agency, fuelling fears that the process could be scrapped.
Thanks for that. They caught up. that was a good story. That is true, but the business case, there is concern over it at the moment, but what the concern over that is that, there are rumours that this could now be falling apart within weeks because the business case doesn't quite stack up. The Cabinet Office are concerned, and this is largely due to the issues that, just to defend ourselves there on the scooping point, that we've brought to light and the unions have brought to light. But also because the maths doesn't quite work and the American pressure is so high. So there is a real issue, but they've got an alternative option, which is called Defence Equipment and Support Plus. No one really knows what that means. And the issue of that is how are they going to modify it if they're not going to use this semi-privatisation option.
Well, one would expect PCS Union to be, and the representing staff from DENS, to be ideologically against it. But what practical reasons have they come up with where they're saying that this is a bad idea?
Well, for example, something we wrote the other day was, which actually I had to say hadn't come up before, but a very interesting point, is that, let's say, you've got one of the contractors who works for a state that we suddenly go to war with. What is their interest? Is it to buy the guns quickly for us? Is it to honour their contracts with them? How would you really have a proper Chinese war at that point?
Well, and also they might supply guns that don't work.
I don't know. But it's an interesting point. That's one of them. And then job cuts also. Will they honour the terms? What has an American company got the same interest in investing in skills as a British company would? I'm not sure I'd buy all these arguments, I have just to point out, but these are the sort of issues that they come up with.
Okay, finally, how open have you found the Ministry of Defence about the process? It's obviously very controversial, fantastic amounts of our public money potentially being diverted in a completely different direction. How have you found the MOD?
On the whole, not wildly helpful on this, but I think there's partly it's an issue that they're trying to get to grips with, and they're trying to get to grips with it very quickly. I think that, as we were saying earlier, there are certain issues where they have legitimate concerns over national security or commercial confidentiality, but at the same time, if they can't release information as to why one bid is better than the other, why certain people excluded and others have, I don't think we can just take it at face value. I write and done a lot on high speed too. There's nothing wrong with high speed too, I don't think, as an actual concept, but the way it's been implemented and the way they ask us to take things at face value that turn out to be untrue, for example, the budget, these things do need to be scrutinised, and that goes across all of these outsourcing and major contracts.
Ultimately, do you think it will happen or not?
I don't think this option will go ahead in its current form. I think there are too many issues. I mean, if they get it through, it will be a great feat, and frankly, it will be because they've been hugely successful in their arguments. But as I see it, I'm not sure how it will happen.
Okay, Mark Lefley from The Independent and The Evening Standard, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thank you.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
And now I'm joined by Daphne Habercroft from Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. Hi, Daphne, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, thanks, Tony. Tony. Good to be here.
Al, what have you got for us this week? Because, I mean, we have you on here probably every couple of months looking at what's been going on with the health service. I mean, we've got this new thing now called clinical commissioning groups where doctors are actually spending health service budgets. So what have you been finding out about that for us over the last few weeks?
Well, there's quite a lot of interesting stuff going on. So, for example, a couple of days ago, I went to a local health authority scrutiny meeting of the health scrutiny committees of Bristol and South Gloucestershire councils, where they were looking at what the NHS was doing in terms of an update on a merger of pathology services. And it's all stalled.
Okay, just tell us, what is pathology? Is it something to do with blood? I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's blood. It's if you need diagnostic tests to find out if you've got a disease or not, so it could be
blood tests. Okay.
Yeah, that sort of thing, looking to see if you've got cancer, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, because we've had a few problems with that in the past, haven't we?
Yes, we have, yeah.
Where people have been wrongly diagnosed for whatever reason. Maybe one test tube got swapped over with another one, and of course that can devastate somebody's life. Anyway, what's happening with pathology then?
Well, the plan was to merge the pathology services for North Bristol NHS Trust and for University Hospitals Bristol, which manages the BRI, and Western Area Health Authority, the hospital down there. So North Bristol has got all this funding and has built some new laboratories up at Southmead. But what seems to have happened is that University Hospitals Bristol and Western have decided at the moment they can't go ahead with this because it's not going to deliver the savings that they originally anticipated. So the councillors were not very happy about this because back in April these proposals were brought to them and they felt that it was a positive development, lots of potential. And they asked the NHS to come back and give them an update because they got questions about how long is it going to take, what are the qualities and savings going to be, and how are you actually going to manage this thing, bringing three services together. So they weren't too happy to suddenly be told, well, actually, we've stalled. And some very penetrating questions were asked of the NHS about, well, when did you make this decision? And eventually it came out that it was made in June. So the councillors said, well, how come we've only just found out about it?
Well, this is always one of the worries, isn't it, as things start to get a bit privatised, is that people would rather just not talk about things than fess up, put their hands up in the air and say, actually, this is proving to be a bit of a dog's breakfast.
Yeah, well, it's all got a bit peculiar because the NHS mentioned that one of the things that had led to this slowdown was what they described as complexity in competition and cooperation regulations. And so they were asked questions about, well, is this really a problem of finances, that it's not going to deliver the savings you anticipated, or is it that you are being subject to more review by regulators such as the Cooperation Competition Panel, which is part of Monitor now, and possibly the Office of Fair Trading. So it's all got a bit peculiar because if you look at board papers of University Hospitals Bristol, that clearly indicates that this merger was under scrutiny by Monitor. Well, Monitor have told me that no, they're not looking at it. They don't know if the Office of Fair Trading is looking at it. So it's all a bit mysterious
why shouldn't they just change their mind if they think it's not the best thing to do? They've got to, you know, they should turn the ship around, really, shouldn't they, rather than carry on with something they don't think is going to work?
Well, the thing is that they spent a lot of time and energy and brought in an advisory panel, which was headed by Dr. Ian Barnes, who's the Department of Health's national lead on pathology. And he and his panel produced a report back in July 2012 and said that they really needed to do some more work on their business case, and they weren't satisfied that they'd actually really fleshed it out to be able to show that they could achieve the savings they were able to do. So over a year later, they still haven't been able to do that. And you think, well, why not? You know, that's what you're paid to do. So why haven't you been able to put together a business case that can take you forward?
Now, is there any more news on this proposed merger between the two trusts? Because I know we've got basically two big trusts. I suppose the biggest hospital in North Bristol is Frenchay and Southmead, and we've got the University Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust, the Central Bristol Trust, which used to control the General Hospital until that was sold off for housing, which doesn't seem to have been built yet. But anyway, so we've got the two trusts. Each has a budget of around about £500 million a year. Each of them is chaired by a merchant venturer. We've got Peter Rillett, I think, who's the chairman of the North Bristol Trust, and we've got John Savage, who's the chairman of the Central Trust. That's the University Hospitals Bristol Trust. And there was talk. Crazy talk, if you ask me about it, about the idea of closing the BRI's accident and emergency and moving it up to Southmead. That seems to have been scotched now. That was about 6-8 months ago. But there is still, as I understand it, some proposals hanging around in the background to merge the two trusts to a massive £1 billion Bristol Super Trust.
Well, they've never gone so far as to actually announce that they're merging, and they've got the issue of one's a foundation trust and one isn't. But they did a couple of years ago enter into a partnership to work together and look at where they could try and amalgamate services, and they did that in March this year. So they merged their services of breast care, so that's up at Southmead, the symptomatic service, urology is up at Southmead, and head and neck, ear, nose and throat and oral maxillofacial services are at the BRI. But that was subject to a review by Monitor, who found that overall they didn't see that there was actually necessarily going to be an improvement in the quality of services. So that was looked at. But there's something coming up for review at Bristol Council's Health Scrutiny Committee coming Tuesday the 15th. And this is the Bristol Acute Services Review. And so the paper's already been published, it's up on the internet. And this review was conducted by a board that was overseen or chaired by Professor Steve West, who's the Vice Chancellor at UWE, University of the West of England, and various NHS bodies. And it says the review identified a financial challenge facing the two trusts in Bristol in excess of £230 million over the next 5 years. So the medical directors and the chief nurses of the two trust boards were asked to come up with some thoughts about areas they could look at to see if they could promote more partnership working. And they've got a list of things like trauma, orthopaedics, rheumatology, general surgery, maternity, cardiology, and a few others. But what they've said is that it should be noted that the estimated total savings from these opportunities does not exceed £2 million. So they've still got a huge hole to fill in closing that gap. Another interesting point is that they obtained for this review external advice from PwC, the consultancy company.
PricewaterhouseCoopers used to be,
using funds made available by the former NHS South of England Strategic Health Authority. So the question in my mind was, if you've got this big gap to plug, why are you bringing in consultants at undisclosed public expense to advise you? And isn't that what you, the directors of these organisations, being paid to do? So what are these consultants doing that you can't do? And so the upshot of it, there's this paper that they're presenting, it just is really, it says there's limited number of options that they can do. They're looking at collaborations, but their overall conclusion says that they've identified a very challenging financial outlook for the acute sector in Bristol and the wider health and social care system. The review fell short of identifying a means of closing the financial gap across the two acute trusts. And it says that it clearly demonstrated that the greatest gains in potential to improve patient care and reduce overall system costs will come through integration of services between the health and social care sectors. and also alongside the simplification of the existing urgent and emergency care pathways in Bristol, North Somerset and South Gloucestershire. And a factor that is relevant to this is that Western Hospital is now being looked at as to who is going to run that in the future. And I understand that University Hospitals Bristol is one of the potential bidders for that. So that there's a lot of things up in the air.
Yes, and it's not...
And a big
not,
financial gap and no clear way of closing
it. Yes, it's not necessarily the very best way to run a health service by leaving lots of things up in the air. And you would think that you would want to change things little bit by bit, little bit, and not to commit to too much until you know whether something new is going to work or not. So what about other pressure groups and things in the area, apart from yourselves, Daphne? Because I know that there are some that are keeping a very close eye on these clinical commissioning groups and looking at whether the wisdom or otherwise of this whole move to privatise the health service.
Well, it's very difficult to find out what's going on because the NHS surrounds themselves with organisations that really are not going to ask them incisive questions. And so, for example, the local involvement networks that we used to have, which were supposed to represent local patient and public interest, were disbanded in March this year, and they're now replaced by an organisation called Health Watch, which has local bodies. The Health Watch for Bristol and South Gloucestershire and Somerset and Bath and North East Somerset is very difficult to work out who is actually supposed to be representing public interests. And those organisations, these health watches, are under the management of a voluntary sector organisation called the Care Forum. They've got websites, but it's very difficult to find out who is actually involved in Health Watch, because they do call themselves consumer champions, and what meetings they're having. And my impression is it's all rather a cosy club between the NHS and public organisations that they like to surround themselves with, and nobody else can really get a look in and find out what's going on very well.
Well, one could cite to go online a Twitter feed as well as Keep Our NHS Public. But on a more practical level, there's been a bit of a fuss, hasn't there, up in French A. I don't know if you've been following this, Daphne.
Yeah.
I mean, I went along to one of the public meetings up there about 18 months ago because the French A campus, that hospital was considered to be one of the best in the country, even though it was put, I think, there World War II or the end of World War II, been there for a long, long time, but brilliantly run. The North Bristol Trust, in its wisdom, decided that we're going to close that site and move everybody over to Southmead. Now, the obvious reason for that is because French A property prices, if you wanted to buy a nice little semi-detached house in French A, are astronomical. And so the local people are getting more and more angry over this. 500 homes planned and a primary school on the former French A hospital site. What is it about the way that the NHS is now run that means that some of the best sites are actually being just sold off to the highest bidder? Effectively here, this is a housing developer.
Yeah, I think it's to plug the big financial gaps they've got. So that's why they do it, I think.
I mean, the financial gap, of course, is partly due to the, almost 100% probably, due to the massive private finance initiative to build the Southmead Hospital. Martin, well, where is this actually leading? Because this is something that the health service, traditionally, they would keep good sites. They wouldn't be selling them off in order to build new hospitals. And is it as simple as that, that French A has just been abandoned because it's high property prices in order to pay for this new hospital? Actually, what is effectively to have to pay for it twice over, because we're paying a massive amount of extra money because it's a PFI.
Well, the PFIs were obviously a disaster, and it was the previous government that...
But you can't say that. Yes, well, it's New Labour, and you can't say that because at least we've got a new hospital. Otherwise, there wouldn't be one at Southmead.
Yeah, well, they could easily have funded it by... I mean, it's using public funds, but kicking the can down the road so that you actually end up paying more. You should have been straightforward about it and say, if we want a new hospital, we've got to raise the money, and it actually makes more sense for central government to raise that money. They can borrow money much more cheaply than any hospital trust can borrow money. I mean, the whole idea of running the NHS like a business is misconceived, in my view. I mean, the original conception of the NHS was it would be top-down planned. Now, of course, there's obviously problems with things being top-down planned, but on the other hand, if you want to have a cheap, efficient service, top-down planning is one of the ways that you do it. I mean, for example, you don't run an army as a business, and you don't run a health service like that either.
Of course, the French Hay isn't Bristol, it's South Gloucestershire. And up there, Councillor Dave Hockey, who's chairman of the Development Control Committee, who's going to make these decisions about planning, whether they get planning permission, told residents there'd be no debate at the meeting last week, and that councillors had simply come to hear views and for and against the development and to conduct a site visit. But resident Richard Hill, who's 56, he's a committee member and treasurer of French Hay Residents Users Group, which opposes the plan, said the residents user group now has well over 1,000 members. The mood of local residents has changed from one of frustration to one of anger. We feel we've been lied to by the trust. At a presentation we attended in March 2012, that might be the one I went to actually, we were told to expect around 350 homes. Now it's gone up to 490 homes. That may well be policy compliant, but it is not in keeping with the rest of French Hay. Mr Hill said residents were also angry about plans to cut down 58 lime trees on the site and claimed a traffic survey was totally inaccurate, conducted during the summer holidays. He said residents felt they'd been shut out of the planning process the last year and simply wanted constructive dialogue with the trust. We are not NIMBYs, we all accept, he said, that there is going to be development there. We have just have our own practical and sensible ideas about how it should be done. Gerald Rosenberg, chairman of governors at French Hay Primary School, spoke about how plans for a new school on the site would be divisive if the second entirely separate primary school is built on the hospital site without addressing the needs of the current school. It'll be undoubtedly compete with adverse consequences for the existing school. Alan Freak, chairman of French Hay Village Museum, also spoke about concerns to the museum building, which lies within the hospital grounds, because the application only safeguards the building. Sounds to me like they've kicked up a bit of a storm here, Daphne, and actually what's happening is that even though the developers are actually doing this, a lot of the flak is going to North Bristol Trust. What on earth are you doing handing this land over to these people who are now, as he says, they are lying to us?
Well, there's two arms to this. There's the residents who aren't happy about what's going on where they live, but there's also the broken promises about the French Hay Community Hospital and the 68 beds there. So South Gloucestershire Health Scrutiny Committee are having the clinical commissioning group back in October, 23rd of October, to provide them some more information, because they're not happy that plans to have the community hospital and diagnostic facilities at French Hay, which were first put together in 2005 when the plans to have the PFI build at Southmead were discussed and then reinforced in 2010. And now the NHS is reneging on it and saying, well, there's no money to do it, and talking about having some of these services at Cosham. So they're rather craftily, in my view, going to Bristol Council Health Scrutiny Committee this Tuesday to tell them their plans. And how they're going to sell it is, well, oh, Cosham will have these services here because you don't want to go out to French Hay, it's closer for you in Bristol. But then what about the people in South Gloucestershire who don't have any hospital, won't have any hospital in South Gloucestershire if French Hay doesn't take place, apart from maybe Thornbury, and there's all sorts of discussions going on about promises made there. They were promised a hospital at French Hay, community hospital, and the NHS has backtracked on that. Okay, you know, financial changes happen, but you have to take people with you and keep them informed of the changes and consult with them, not spring it on them when the money's gone.
Well, that's certainly one of the things that's happened at French Hay as well. Now, I asked this to Mark Leftley, who was on a minute ago talking about the privatisation or part privatisation of Abbey Wood, the defence equipment and support up there. But how have you found, I mean, you're doing a fantastic job going to these various meetings, finding out what's going on, keeping an eye on them. But how have you found the modern NHS in actually letting you know what they're doing? I mean, literally doing things like making sure that agendas are available for meetings. I mean, this is all public money that they're spending. So how accessible is the new process, the clinical commissioning groups and these kinds of things? And how accessible have you found it? You know, and have there been any changes since it was, they're moving towards this more private system way of doing things?
Well, it's actually got worse finding out what's going on. So, for example, in Bristol, you've got an organisation, the Bristol Health Partnership, Which is actually, I think, a social enterprise and is involved in doing some of the primary care work that the Bristol Primary Care Trust used to do. So they're not subject to freedom of information, for example. I've used freedom of information, and as soon as it gets to the point where the NHS thinks you've got enough information to build up a picture of what's going on, you find that your subsequent requests are refused as vexatious.
Hang on a minute, vexatious? But
yeah, vexatious.
Really, they say that? That you're actually trying to find out what's going on with public money, and they're coming back to you and saying...
And that attitude is upheld by the Information Commissioner and the Information Tribunal, which is part of the Ministry of Justice, where you go if you want to appeal these things. So I've been accused of grossly misusing the Freedom of Information Act by the Information Tribunal.
Okay, give us an idea of what sort of info you were trying to get at that stage.
Trying to get information about standards of care. So, for example, a Freedom of Information request that first was bounced back as vexatious was where I asked Bristol Primary Care Trust for information about quality of services that she had asked North Bristol NHS Trust for. It was the same information she'd asked the Trust for, information that people are entitled to under the NHS Constitution to find about the quality of services to help you decide, well, is this a good provider or not? And it was bounced back as vexatious.
Crazy. Anyway, fantastic stuff you're doing, Daphne. More power to your elbow. Can you just tell us whereabouts we can find you online and how people can get in touch if they want to blow the whistle?
Yep.
Oh, you've just passed me your card.
If
I can read it. Right. Well, anyway, the website is SWW HAG, Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. That stands for SWWHAG.wordpress.com. You'll find Daphne. And the phone number is 07971 968244. On email, swwhistleblowers@gmail.com. So, Daphne Havercroft, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thank you, Tony.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Martin, MI5's chief's been criticising Edward Snowden this week, hasn't he? Saying basically he's putting the country at risk.
Well, he has, yes, and he's Andrew Parker. He's been calling the Guardian diary Andrew Nosy Parker, which I think is a pretty good pseudonym for the head of MI5. He's basically sticking his nose into what is this extremely politically contentious area.
But isn't that his job? He's the head of MI5, for goodness sake.
Well,
he's got to have the courage to speak out.
Stella Rimmington, who's the former head of MI5, is actually criticising what he's been saying. And, of course, he's replaced Jonathan Evans, who mysteriously resigned after the Olympics, and nobody's quite sure why he went, although he's now head of security.
I can tell you why he went, because he got it wrong, didn't he, with the Olympics.
There may be other things going on there as well. But in actual fact, the head of MI5, in my view, shouldn't be making contentious statements about anything very much. I mean, in the past, we never even knew who they were. Now they're making contentious statements. And, of course, Jonathan Evans has now gone to be head of security at the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, HSBC.
Which has, of course,
been convicted of money laundering. And the suspicion is that Evans removed himself before some serious stuff started to happen that he might be blamed for, because he'd lose his pension if that came through. Now, I think if the heads of MI5 want to enter the political debate, let's enter the political debate. Let's talk about what you've really been up to and what kind of supervision you've really been under. Because, of course, Chris Hoon was saying about the GCHQ that as a cabinet minister responsible for it, he had no idea what they were up to. And I think that says everything about what's happened to the security services during the War on Terror era.
On a more practical and a local level, hasn't Jonathan Evans got himself quite a nice car as a retirement present?
Well, he said he was going to get himself a four-door Maserati, and a four-door Maserati certainly appeared parked in the right drive of John Bradenkampf in Kilmersdown. John Bradenkampf, of course, is a major arms dealer, and is actually being questioned at the moment. He's trying to get his assets unfrozen.
Well, it could be he was just out on a long drive, he was driving down near Froome and the car broke down and he had to pull in.
We don't really know, but what I would suggest to you is that when you've got a revolving door where the head of MI5 then ends up working for a major bank which has been convicted of money laundering, it's time for alarm bells to ring.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to this interesting little speech. This is by Andrew Parker. You say nosy Parker, I didn't say anything at all. I'm not allowed to. This is the boss of MI5 and he gave a speech this week. I'm going to bring it to you now, absolutely determined that you should hear what this guy's all about.
My name's Andrew Parker, I'm the Director General of MI5.
And that was it, I'm afraid. He just said who he was. My name is Andrew Parker, I'm the Director General of MI5. Nothing else was allowed to be recorded. And the rest of it was an off-the-record briefing to trusted journalists. Now, it doesn't say a lot for... he doesn't seem to trust most journalists. He's only talking to, like, a handful of the national journalists in London, Martin, and that's all he's prepared to say to the rest of the public.
Well, yes, and I think what he's actually doing is interfering in... I mean, it was coordinated with the Daily Mail, it looks like, an attack upon the Guardian for printing the story.
And the Times and the Telegraph.
Yes, indeed. But, I mean, the point is that the NSA revelations by Snowden, the German government, the Brazilian government, lots of governments around the world are extremely happy about what he's told them, or rather unhappy about what they've found out about what's going on. I mean, I put a straight question to Nosy Parker, are you involved in economic espionage? Because if you are, the Germans and the Brazilians want to know about it. And if you are, there may be sort of trade deals that you're trying to do with the BRICS countries, with other European countries, are all off because MI5 is involved in industrial espionage.
Well, one person that does know what's going on at GCHQ, at least he knew what used to go on there, is their former boss, David Omand. And he, rather than just give his name, he's retired now, so he seems able to talk a little bit more freely. He's not part of the cult anymore. David Omand gave an interview to the BBC, and this is what he had to say.
If you want the state to have the capability to keep us safe from terrorists and serious criminals, then you have to give the state the capability to find their communications. You then have to make sure that it's being properly used. Computers aren't conscious. What is actually happening is that the computers are combing through the billions of transactions on the internet, and they are looking for the IP addresses, for the signatures of the computers and mobile phones of the terrorists and the serious criminals and the proliferators and the other targets. So that's what's going on, and that's why it's so important to have access to communication data so that the agencies and law enforcement can find out who's in communication with whom. But nobody's reading all your emails or all my emails. Are you prepared to support the opposite proposition, that you don't want the state to be able to read your emails? Because if you say that, you're saying that law enforcement, the police and the intelligence agencies shouldn't be able to track the terrorists who are trying to plant bombs in our midst, or track the serious criminals who are defrauding us, track the kidnappers, track the paedophiles. I don't think the British public would support that. They want law enforcement and the agencies to have that capability, but they want it controlled. And I'm satisfied that there is now that kind of control.
Well, he's satisfied, Martin, but are you satisfied? I know there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence for that. The other thing is, out of the window seems to be this whole thing of checks and balances, whereby whenever information is wanted by GCHQ, they have to go and ask a judge, is it okay if we collect information, and it's for a limited period. They have to actually prove that they've got a reason to do it.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, has recently produced a book that came out in December 2012, basically about NATO intelligence services themselves being involved in terrorism, based upon investigations by the Italian police force. Now, what people have got to understand, and I know it's very difficult for them to understand it, having been fed a diet of James Bond films all their lives, people in Belfast know what we're talking about. Actually, the Western intelligence services are themselves terrorists. They bombed Bologna Railway Station in 1980, the Piazza Fontana bombing of 1969, the Dublin and Monaghan bombs, according to the Irish police force, were linked to MI5. Now, when you've got MI5, and MI5 were definitely linked to those bombs, when MI5 are the terrorist suspects, are we happy for them to be allowed to look at everybody else's emails when they are themselves suspects? What I would suggest as a check and balance is, yes, we have intelligence services and they do what they do and they must be supervised and so on, but the police should be watching them because they, in fact, are frequently suspects for terrorist attacks. And ultimately, we are going to catch the terrorists, for example, who did 9/11, and we're not going to find them in a cave in Afghanistan. We're going to find them somewhere else.
Martin, the chap we just heard from, David Omand there, the former head of GCHQ, was saying that they do need to keep everybody under surveillance because they need to catch the terrorists, the criminals and the paedophiles.
Well, I would suggest that the intelligence services themselves need to be kept under surveillance by the police, who are answerable to the political authorities. Because ultimately, I believe people like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, for example, who was basically fingered by Sir John Stevens as the mastermind of the Loyalist paramilitary campaign in Northern Ireland, he disappeared to Iraq. I want to see those people arrested. But of course, they're not outside the intelligence services. They are in the intelligence services. And I want to see the police feel their collar. But you don't do that by giving the intelligence services more power than they deserve. And ultimately, the intelligence services for years have been saying, we've not been doing this. And now they've been caught out saying, yes, we are doing it, but we should be allowed to. Now, hang on a minute. A minute ago, you were telling us you weren't doing it. Now you're saying you are, but you should be allowed to. That's prima facie evidence that you are lying about this and about lots of other things as well.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, it will take another 9/11 for Britain to go to war abroad, said Government Minister. Britain is war-weary and only extreme circumstances like the 9/11 attacks could persuade the public to support a major new foreign deployment, says Philip Hammond, Defence Secretary. This is in the Daily Telegraph. The costly campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan have put voters off foreign wars. So there won't be another foreign war, he says, anyway, Philip Hammond says, unless there's another 9/11.
Well, let's talk about 9/11. This has clearly changed an awful lot of things, and on this programme we've never shied away from talking about 9/11. Let's talk about what really happened on 9/11. According to the head of the Russian armed forces on the day, General Leonid Ivashov, as far as he's concerned, and he's got access to all secret Russian intelligence, that was an inside job. According to Major General Stubblebine of the US military, he thinks it's an inside job. So does Colonel Sabrowski, a Jewish-American officer who used to be Director of Studies at the US Army War College. He thinks it's an inside job. I am in favour of catching terrorists. I'm in favour of using legal methods, proper judges giving warrants for people's phones to be tapped and all the rest of it, and we will find out who in fact was responsible for 9/11, and it wasn't people in Afghanistan, it was people inside our own security forces. MI6 were the lead agency on Operation Cyclone, which armed all the rebels in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, is all over the television in France over the last few weeks, saying that in actual fact, the British approached him at an international meeting saying, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Lavrov, who's the current foreign minister of Russia, is now saying, we have evidence that in actual fact, the chemical weapons attack outside Damascus was carried out by the rebels with help from the Turks and the Syrians, who are and the Saudis, who are in fact our allies. Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia was in Israel this week, apparently. That's what it says on the Israeli media. And he also went to Russia not long ago to talk to Putin and said, if you don't do what we want over Syria, we are going to unleash our Chechen terrorists that we fund and train on your Olympic Games in Sochi. And this was all reported in the Daily Telegraph. I'm all in favour of catching terrorists, especially if they've got scrambled egg on their hats and they are officers inside the Western military intelligence structure. I want to see these people executed. Under existing US law, if it's found out that elements within the CIA were responsible for 9/11, they don't just get a slap on the wrist, they don't just get sent to prison, they get lethal injections. Bring it on.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
And also, Martin, this week, Mercedes-Benz has been showcasing its driverless technology. Now, this technology is running way ahead of everything. Vehicle manufacturer Mercedes-Benz has revealed the progress it's made with its driverless technology by taking an S500 intelligent drive concept car on a 100-kilometre trip in the south of Germany. Luxury car firm set out to reenact the journey made by Bertha Benz, the wife of the firm's founder, Carl Benz, in 1888 to demonstrate the suitability of the Benz patent motor car for everyday use. 125 years later, Mercedes-Benz has set out to prove a similar point using driverless technology developed on the basis of the new S-Class S500 intelligent drive research vehicle, autonomously covered the 100 kilometres between Mannheim and Pforzheim, the firm wrote in a statement. Yet unlike Bertha Benz all those years ago, it didn't have the road all to itself. It had to negotiate the dense traffic and complex traffic simulations using its computer with no driver.
Yes, interesting this stuff, isn't it? Because also the Michael Hastings, the journalist who died in a very mysterious car crash in a Mercedes-Benz.
He was an investigative journalist working for Rolling Stone and investigating one of the former bosses of the CIA.
Yes, he was investigating the CIA and the FBI, and then he had a very mysterious car crash, did he not? I can't remember how long ago, some months ago. And a lot of the suggestion on the internet is that car was he was in the car, but it was being driven by somebody else, as it were, at a distance. Incidentally, we were talking about 9/11 a minute ago. Global Hawk technology has existed to fly aeroplanes without a pilot since the 1970s. In fact, a plane was flown from the US to Australia without a pilot in 1971. And of course, the planes on 9/11 flew around inside US airspace without being intercepted by any fighter planes for an hour and a half. They didn't fly directly to the targets. They flew around all over the place before they jinked and jerked about before they ended up where they ended up. The suspicion is that those planes were being flown from the ground. And if you think for a moment, flying a plane from the ground or driving a car at a distance is a technology that's been around for about a generation.
Well, I wonder what insurance companies would say if you were run over by a driverless car. I mean, who's going to be the person who takes the rap? Is it going to be the company goes to court? Is it going to be the individual operator, the programmer that goes to court? It seems like quite often this technology is running way ahead of any kind of law and legislation.
Well, it is, and the point is that this technology was probably used on 9/11 to fly the planes from the ground. Global Hawk, people can check it. The technology has existed for at least 20 or 30 years, and all you've got to do is, you know, take over the plane from the ground, and then you can fly it directly to the they didn't fly directly to the target. That's the interesting thing. If they'd flown directly to the target, you could have argued that they programmed the onboard computers to just fly directly to the target, but none of the planes flew directly to the target. They actually took a bizarre roundabout course to get to their targets, and of course the only way that could have been done is by flying from the ground.
Well, about 8 months ago in Holland, a hacking conference, somebody demonstrated, they didn't actually do it, but they demonstrated how they could actually log into the system which would control a plane which was flying over their head from their mobile phone.
Yeah, and that's just a random person. So imagine what the intelligence services and the security services have got already. The question is, as always, who will guard the guardians? And of course, what we've actually got is a situation where elements, I'll put it most strongly than this, elements within the Western security forces are in fact carrying out terrorist acts in order to gain more power for their own infrastructure to be funded and for them to carry on doing what they do. And of course, we're gradually moving towards a police state through these acts of terrorism, most of which have been coordinated from inside the security structure.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
We finished this week by looking at some real super money scamsters at the end of World War II and what happened to the Nazi gold. A little bit of American radio. It's Radio Free America with Tom Valentine interviewing US Marine Corps' Trenton Parker.
I don't know anything about Martin Bormann, but you said he was still alive in 1975, and yet how did he manage to escape the Mossad all these years and the Israeli Nazi hunters?
Well, first of all, while the history books say Martin Bormann was killed outside the bunker in Berlin, the Mossad and people who have been deeply active in chasing down these particular people, they knew and have known full well that Martin Bormann was not dead, and that he had been spotted and what have you, and there's so much documentation to indicate this.
Well, see, I'm not a big follower of that stuff, so I just don't know.
I don't have first-hand information, but I've certainly met enough people in the Mossad and other people involved in intelligence. He got out of Berlin. He went into the mountains. He came out through Italy. He used various passports. He then got into Spain, and Spain was a haven. It was also an exit place. A lot of the submarines that were thought to be sunk were not sunk. They were simply moved through Bormann by Bormann's orders, circumventing High German Naval Command, and they became pickup points. A number of tankers were simply sent off in the Sargasso Sea area where they sat. They became the refueling places, and those submarines were brought into the deep water ports in and around the Atlantic, Spanish deep water ports. They refueled mid-Atlantic. They made it into South America.
Well, that's Tom Ballantyne's show. Actually, Trenton Parker there, Martin, again, saying that actually the intelligence services know a lot more than we do about these kinds of things. Anyway, time to sign off now. Up next, Cyrus the Virus, and we have a bit of a special talking about all sorts of things, the end of the world and that kind of stuff, as well as some John Peel music too. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor of Southville Ward, leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Tess Green. I'll also be back here at 5 o'clock next week.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.